Hi Tom, hi Steve. Ich wünsche euch eine tolle Show. Vielleicht kann ich bald meinen Senf dazugeben.
Welcome to Masters of Profundication. I'm Tom Witham.
I'm Steve Biles.
And we're here, podcasting. We're
very,
very creative in the ways that we podcast.
It's a tour de force. It's a avant-garde, conceptual, you know, modern art masterpiece is what we're doing here, because we are very creative and crazy guys.
Speaking of being creative, it's a difficult thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And which is why we're going to talk about it today on Masters of Profundication.
That's profound.
I just said the most uncreative thing in the world, so starting off right.
I was going to be an artist when I was a kid.
Okay, so when you say artist, what do you mean by drawing, painting?
When I was...
Performance. Please say performance.
Oh, no. I wish. When I was a little lad, I used to spend a lot of time at my grandparents'. And so I'd sit down and I'd write these books and draw the pictures that go along with the books. And my grandmother used to tell me what a good artist I was. Oh, my goodness, you're going to be an artist one day. You're going to be an artist one day. Of course, that's what a grandmother says, right?
Yeah. Grandmother, parents, whatever. Yep.
I'm sure the pictures I was drawing were shit. But the fact that she planted that seed and told me I was going to be an artist one day, I actually thought I was going to be an artist in the same exact way that, and it made way for other things, but I thought I was going to be an artist, just exactly like I thought I was going to be an archaeologist in Egypt, uncovering the Ark of the Covenant.
First, you had your bullwhip ready to go, your fedora.
Yep. Yeah, so in the same vein, I was going to be an artist when I grew up.
And see, I have a completely parallel story to that, because I did essentially the same thing. I wrote when I was a kid. I wrote the most derivative story you could ever see. I basically ripped off every fantasy horror book I ever read. Stephen King, Terry Brooks, everything in the world. I ripped it all off. Lord of the Rings, and wrote a story, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
That was a story. It was my own creation. And I drew the pictures that went along with it by copying comic books, video game manuals, anything I could think of that had a character that I thought was cool looking. And I would just basically copy that character and change the setting a little bit. And I thought I did okay for a kid for drawing, but it was a talent that I never kept up myself. I never practiced enough to make it real.
Did you show this to anybody? Did you have any feedback? Or?
Oh, yeah.
What drove you?
I had no shame. I showed my brother. I told my parents. I showed a friend in school. I don't know. When I do something like this, I feel like I want as many people to read as possible. Because I'm ooh, look what I did. I'm special and creative. Mm. Which is something you can attest to. And we'll probably talk about that later. But
yeah. I wrote a story when I was in third grade. I could probably put my hands on it. I'm sure my parents still have it. But it was on that elementary school green paper that's got the lines.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. And, yeah, olive green, yeah.
Yeah, and I have a story that's probably 15, 20, maybe 10, 15 pages. And, boy, I was brutal in it. I was absolutely brutal. All my friends were in it, and we were on a quest.
Yeah.
And there was lava pits that we had to traverse, and it was quite a story, and I killed off all my friends. But the twist is my best friend at the time was the hero, and I actually died in the story.
See, that's fine. That's very self-deprecating. It's good.
Yeah, but it was at the end. He and I were the two left standing, and I'm sure it was some self-sacrifice that made me appear to be the hero. I can't
and then
remember.
I got the girl that touched her booby, and it was good.
I can't remember exactly how it ended, but for a third grader, that it was all right, and I didn't create these Mary Sue characters that.
Yeah, everybody dies. It's the opposite of Mary Sue. Well, maybe your friend. I don't know.
It was very Whedon-esque.
Some witty banter and
there was witty banter and
deep symbolism.
A lot of people died. Main characters died. A lot of all the main characters died, but one.
Was there a sassy girl that kicked ass? Because that's
I think it was all
almost
dudes.
A necessary part of being Whedon-esque.
It would not have passed the Bechdel test.
It was
all dudes on a mountain preparing to save the world.
Is there an opposite of the Bechdel test? I mean, is there a test you can do to say, okay, all dudes that don't even mention women whatsoever?
I don't know.
It's the
there was no woman girls involved. Well, I don't know.
The Brokeback Test.
The Brokeback Test. Okay, we've started a new thing. The Brokeback Test. Right. Does your story include just dudes? Are they shirtless and oiled up?
Did they not give a flying fuck about there being women anywhere nearby?
Basically, you take the movie 300 and all the fight scenes that does not pass the Brokeback Test. Or maybe it passes the Brokeback Test. I don't know how we're doing this.
Once Lena Headey got out of there, you could have it. It would pass.
So, being creative is hard. I guess what we just established is that it can start at a very, very early age. But if you don't maintain it or if you don't foster that creativity, it's very, very, very hard.
Yeah. And I feel like it's insidiously hard. Like, okay, here's what I mean. I feel like everybody is creative. Everybody. If you are a functional human being, not like brain dead, you are going to be creative at some point in some way in your life.
Hell, they have elephants that paint and monkeys that paint, stuff like that. So, I mean,
sure.
Then again, it's the eye of the beholder stuff. Go ahead.
A functional human being / monkey / elephant. Anyway, maybe dolphin. But yeah, I mean, even if it's something weird, like decorating your house, you know, I'm going to pick this picture and put it on the wall, or I'm going to arrange my chairs a certain way. Your creativity will come out in some way, shape, or form, and you're going to be proud of yourself. For a lot of people, it comes out like what I can make. It doesn't have to be like a picture or a story or something like that. It can be, you know, I put together this stupid IKEA furniture. I did it right the first time. Bam, I'm awesome. That's right. Not necessarily creative, but you are creating, and that's the same impulse, I think. But I feel like the people that never, ever endeavor to be creative in any way are, I don't know, not sad, but like you can tell. Like they feel like it feels like maybe they're missing something and they know it, you know?
A part of their life.
Yeah, wasting a part of their potential. And everybody should find some outlet to be creative in. That's my little PSA for the day. But for the people that do try to be creative, for that set out to, you know, to do something that would, by any definition, be creative, to write a story, to write a screenplay, to make music, to paint a picture, to make a sculpture, whatever you want to do, you know, woodworking, whatever you think you have a talent for, the people that do set out to do that will find all these, like I said, insidious ways that are frustrating and infuriating, that are roadblocks.
I think that that's also magnified by a million times if you're trying to earn a living doing it.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, if you are setting out to be a painter, you can have the most all the talent in the world. You could be one of these people that does like photorealistic drawings where it looks like, you know, you could take a face and draw it and it looks, you know, almost like a black and white snapshot of it. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have a hook or you don't have the connections or the exposure, you could be the most talented person in the world and you can't make a living doing it.
Right. But I imagine that would be maddening to somebody who was set out. Like, I have a friend down in Philly whose wife does, they're both friends, but she creates wreaths. And from what I understand, it might have been a hobby or something that turned into a money-making venture. And I just, like, the stuff that she puts together is phenomenal. Like, probably if Oprah got a hold of it and gave it to her audience, she'd blow up. Probably would have to hire 100 people to help make these wreaths or something like that. But she's doing everything by herself and she's making money by doing it. And the only thing I can think of is, my God, the pressure that she must be under in order to be creative and make these wreaths and then turn them around for some money and stuff like that. Like, I envy her in a way, and then in another way, I'm like, God, I'm glad that's not me. I'm glad that I don't try to earn a living by being creative, because I would be miserable at it.
Yeah, something that you could do for your enjoyment, some part of that, the beautiful part of your soul that comes out, can get crushed by the cold, harsh reality of capitalism.
Nobody wants it.
Right. Or maybe even worse, people do want it for a while. So like maybe you're an author that made two good novels that are praised the high heavens. And then you discover, oh my God, that's all I had in me. I had two good stories in me and that was it.
Right.
And now everybody's expecting you to keep up with that forever. Like everybody expects you to always do as good as you did at your best.
Well, I mean, I know that the guy can't do anything about it because he's dead. But the guy that wrote The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, yeah. Stieg Larsson.
Yeah. He probably could have. I think that might have been his first published works.
Oh, yeah.
And he put out the trilogy. And I almost think that he died before the third one was even published. I think his estate put that out. And then they put out a fourth one, I believe. But he was absolutely on fire. That's one of those things that he probably could have written books for the next two or three decades and been a household name the way he wrote. Yeah. I don't know if you read those. The books were fantastic.
But. No, I've heard good things that I keep. That's one of the things I keep meaning to get into. And I watched the one movie they made.
Yeah,
they
didn't watch it.
Girl with the Dragon Tattoo twice. They didn't make a remake.
Yeah. They're rebooting it.
They didn't do any of the sequels, did they?
No, I think they're rebooting it to do the sequels. I think
so. This will be the second reboot because they've done it. They did it once with
right a Swedish. I think it was was it Swiss? I don't remember. Anyway, they did it. They did it with like a foreign market production company. Then they did it with an American production company or British.
Right.
I don't remember which one. But then that's had Daniel Craig. As
Rooney Mara was a girl.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I believe that they are rebooting the second or the sequel to that. So it's going to be a direct sequel to the first one, but with different actors and actresses.
Yeah, that's a recipe for success.
Yeah. Doesn't sound good. But anyway, but then you have the opposite end of the spectrum. And this is something I really wanted to talk about is ghostwriting.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, because
those are people I feel so bad for.
Well, the way I learned about it, and I'm not even sure exactly how prevalent it is now. I'm sure it's a thing, and I'm sure it's a pretty big thing. But from what I understand, Tom Clancy, people were, you know, clamoring for his type of novels, and mm-hmm. he just didn't have the ability to put out and sit down and write and fill the demand. So he would come up with a premise and write bits and outlines and then let a ghostwriter finish the novel. And to me, as a consumer of that type of story and media and stuff like that, I almost feel cheated, but if I can't tell the difference, you know, really what is the difference? Why should I be bothered by the fact that somebody other than Tom Clancy wrote this? I'm sure there's something deep in the psyche that would determine why I want, you know, the purity of having my story written by the person whose name is on the cover. Because, you know, Stephen King is a Stephen King, Tom Clancy's Tom Clancy, and,
right.
you know, all these authors, like J.K. Rowling, I can't even imagine. I doubt that she ever used a ghostwriter, but...
Oh, there's no way. It feels like there might be almost certain genres that is permissible for, and some that... Like, if you were writing a serialized book, like J.K. Rowling, like the Harry Potter series, and if she got to book, you know, six, and you found out that she just like, oh yeah, here's the rough plot, but somebody else wrote that for me, fans would have lost their minds.
Yeah.
Like, they would have done book burnings if they found that out. That would have been like a divorce betrayal in their minds. But you find out like a James Patterson or, you know, Tom Clancy or, I don't know, I guess there's tons and tons of these authors that put out like thrillers, one-offs, or maybe just a continuation of a certain character, but still they're putting out more and more and more a year. They do exactly that. Like what I read was they come up with a title, maybe the rough plot, and every chapter they'll do like the first paragraph and then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else does the rest of the book. And I found that out. I don't read a lot of those types of books, but if I did, I personally don't think I would have cared. You know, if I was reading all those Alex Cross books and I found out James Patterson only did like 15% of the actual words on page, I'd be like, yeah, all right, that's fine. I'm not reading these to try to change my life or have a profound experience. I just want to entertain myself for a few hours, and I'd be okay with it. But if it was like the Harry Potter books, where if I was one of these kids that grew up reading them, I found out the person that created it started phoning it in by the end and didn't care and pawned it off to somebody else, yeah, I would have felt like my child betrayed.
Can you imagine if George Martin, if you found out that
Yeah, there we go.
Ghostwriter. I mean, we've talked about it before, and we're going to actually feature a whole podcast around Game of Thrones here coming up. But just to think about how deep and rich that story is, to think that somebody else had their hand in that, and that's not like when he's writing those books, which I honestly, I haven't read them. But I understand, I've listened to enough podcasts and I understand, I've seen enough behind the scenes stuff to know that his writing is phenomenal. And I just, I kind of have this picture in my head of his house and he's got a wall dedicated to, you know, with the yarn going from one character to the other and,
yeah,
you know, like scribblings on a page that's taped up and then thumbtacked to a person. And, you know, I just imagine that his encyclopedia is huge, that he has to, his source material that he's created is so gargantuan that there isn't another person that could tap into that. As a matter of fact, I mean, not to change the subject, knowing that you want to talk about Game of Thrones, but the Star Wars Expanded Universe for the longest time had the Star Wars Bible, which was the source material for Star Wars, it was basically just a compendium of data that authors could pull from, because there were so many authors that had their hand in writing these Star Wars books that it all lived in the same universe. And so these authors had to refer to the Star Wars Bible in order to get their story told. And they could do stuff with their own things, but they couldn't make references and they couldn't really tap into the full universe without referencing this book. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, I said, I think there's got to be a something version of that in any comic book headquarters. Like Marvel's going to have a Marvel Bible, which all due respect to Star Wars, the Marvel Bible, the Marvel Bible or the DC Bible would have to put those to shame.
Yeah.
We're talking, 70 years plus of history that some of it's been scrapped and taken away, but especially in the last 20 years, creators have used some of the old history and brought it back in new ways just to find something new to say, something to talk about. But that's neither here nor there. But yeah, so George R. R. Martin, guarantee you, he has, like you said, this wall of connections and plot points. And but I will tell you, at least one author that's would have put him to shame was Robert Jordan. You never read the Wheel of Time series?
No, I didn't. I didn't read it, but
that
I know.
Was it 13 books? Huge doorstopper tomes, like giant books with a cast of thousands. And admittedly, he let that thing get away. He even admitted he let it get away with him. He just like, oh, I just thought of a new character. I threw him in there. I thought of a new character. I threw that in there. And by the end, it was just lousy with all these different little plot points and characters. And it got bad enough that some of the resolutions, quote unquote, on these plot points was horribly unsatisfactory. But it was there, and it was cohesive enough that you still forgave it. I can't imagine what his chart looked like, what his reference book looked like. It was nuts.
Didn't he die?
Yeah, he died before he finished, but he knew he was dying.
He had a ghost.
He took a lot of notes. Yeah, Brandon Sanderson finished the last three books, who did a serviceable job. I was not unhappy with it, but his style of writing was different than Jordan's, and it was noticeable.
Yeah.
So
I think Michael Crichton used a ghostwriter, or his estate used a ghostwriter to finish one of his books as well.
That sounds about right. I mean, they do that all the time.
Yeah.
With all kinds of different media, but one thing I want to say about George R. R. Martin, and getting back to the creativity thing, is this is a guy that simultaneously, and we've talked about this, he's simultaneously almost a genius when it comes to plots and rich worlds and creating, you know, whole cloth ideas and characters. Hand in hand with that, he takes some of the biggest shortcuts you've ever seen a fantasy writer, a sci-fi writer, you know, a fiction writer in general take, which is huge parts of his plot are just ripped straight from history.
Yeah.
So this guy found, creatively speaking, totally making it worse today. That's great. I'm using my creativity.
They'll go into our compendium. So future podcasts that call themselves the Master Burr Foundation will have to reference this.
Creatively, my creatification. All right.
Yes.
Creatively speaking, he very much took shortcuts. You know, scenes like the Red Wedding or the Dothraki, the whole Westeros. I mean, if you look at a map of his world, it kind of jives really closely with the map of like Great Britain or like Europe and Asia, Eurasia together, you know, stuff like that. It very much hits a lot of notes from history. So this is a guy that knew his history, said, I bet people don't know about this story. I could throw it in my books. I bet people really don't know about that story that well. I could throw that in my books too. And boom, there you go.
Did he write anything before the Game of Thrones series?
Yeah, he wrote at least a couple of books. I think there's one called Fever Dream I never read, but I did remember seeing it somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, he wasn't brand new with Game of Thrones or Song of Ice and Fire.
Stephen King wrote a book called On Writing that he describes how he got his start. And he started at a very young age. And I wonder how much of, like, creative wise, how much these famous authors or these people that are actually good at their job, I wonder how much of it started when they were young, because that's what he writes in his book, how he used to write for, you know, these pulp comics, these pulp magazines and stuff like that. H.P. Lovecraft did the same thing.
Almost exclusively.
Yeah. But I'm talking young. Like, the woman that wrote The Outsiders, you know the book, The Outsiders?
Is it the one they made that Starz TV series about? Or am I thinking something else?
No, this is the book.
I was like, Outlander. Oh, Outsiders. Okay, that movie.
The Outsiders with the greasers and the
Pony Boy. I got it, yeah.
Soda Pop. The woman that wrote that, she wrote it when she was 15. It was published when she was 16.
Wow.
And went on to, you know, do some other things. But just imagine how creative she would have had to have been at 15 years old. And she said that she had written some things just for herself, which, I'll be honest with you, I've written a ton of stuff just for myself.
Oh, yeah. I'm with you.
I know that we've talked about that a lot. But, I mean, just something that she wrote, a small story that she wrote, blew up and got to be The Outsiders, for crying out loud, which I think that was required reading for most people our age. It was required reading in high school for me, or that was seventh grade required reading.
Not read that.
That and like Johnny Tremaine and The Merchant of Venice. And
see, here's a confession of mine about the only book I read in either grade school or high school that was considered a classic was To Kill a Mockingbird. I never read any like Great Gatsby or Moby Dick or Catcher in the Rye or anything like that.
Really? Where the Red Fern Grows?
Nope.
God, I could do a list.
I didn't read 1984 until I was in my 30s.
Animal Farm,
you know, Fahrenheit 950, whatever that one is. I always forget which number it is.
451?
451, yeah. None of that. I've never read.
Wait, what's some of the other ones?
With my background, for whatever reason, those books just weren't required, so I never voluntarily read them.
My absolute favorite required reading was Guns of the Navarone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read that twice before the first assignment was due. Like,
wow.
Yeah, I'd read through that a couple times before. I mean, I remember my teacher assigned it, and within that first week, I'd read it twice. But what are some of the other ones? I really liked Where the Red Fern Grows. That was a good book. Should make a list and track those down, put them on my Kindle.
I mean, I love To Kill a Mockingbird. That was a great book.
Yep.
Which makes me wish, I mean, not that all these books are created equal, but it makes me wish I had teachers and stuff that would have forced me to read more of that type of, you know, considered a classic of literature.
God, one is escaping me, and if I described it to you, you'd be able to tell me right off the bat, but I don't want to because I want to come up with myself. But oh, God damn it. It's the one where the two guys go and they become ranch hands, and there's Lenny and there's the big doofus and the little guy that...
Mice and Men?
Of Mice and Men. God damn, Steinbeck. See, that was...
I never read that either, but I know enough about the synopsis of most of these books that I could actually pick them out. But
yeah, I'd like to know. Okay, so these books were written and then they became required reading for, I want to say, like middle school and high school. I wonder when they were written. I wonder if these were written, you know, by adults for adults, but they over time became required reading for high school students.
It became a quintessential part of the American experience that you had.
Yeah.
The system didn't want their kids to miss out on it. Yeah, you know, this actually is a good bridge to something I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
So we have all these required reading books. We just named, you know, the whole litany.
A Wrinkle in Time.
Do you think any new literature coming out is going to be on that list?
Twilight. No, to be perfectly honest with you.
Oh, God, Twilight.
I bet at the bare minimum, the first three Harry Potter books will become, even back ages ago when I worked at the elementary school, I remember the first Harry Potter book came out and the kids in fifth grade were reading it.
I don't know, though.
They had enough copies to give one to each fifth grader, and that was something that they, I don't know if they had to go read it, but at least they got it.
I mean, I see, maybe, but I feel like all these classics of literature, none of them were sci-fi fantasy for them. Not really. Not fantastical fantasy. Not fantastical. Well,
A Wrinkle in Time was absolutely bonkers. I think they're making a movie of that, too. And
I'm sure they already have.
I think they have, and it was shit. But I think they're doing like a serious like production company, big budget, you know, get Dwayne The Rock Johnson to do something, and boom, you got yourself a awesome movie.
I feel like Lord of the Rings was never on one of these like must read. Like, it was something that people read because of the popular culture, but it was not something that was foisted on you by the schools, you know? So if Harry Potter was on the list, that would be departure. But I'm thinking one-off novels. Because, okay, the point I want to make and the thing I want to ask you about is, what do you think of the state of creativity today? And not just books, but movies and music, you know, TV shows.
I think that there is more available to people now than there's ever been. Some kid sitting in their bedroom with a laptop can produce music, you know?
Yeah.
Regardless of the genre of music, but I mean, an electronic, like there's the EDM, the electronic drums and music, you know, that dubstep and things like that. I mean, you can, if you put your nose to the grindstone, you've got the tools right now. Our theme song I created on my iPhone while I was laying in bed, getting ready to go to sleep. You know what I mean? So if I can do it like that, you know that there are some people that are a million times more creative than me that can do things that are, you know, that you just couldn't before. And I think that there's probably, well, it's probably always been the case that there's more creative people than outlets for the creativity. I think now with apps like Fiverr, where you can do freelance, you know, you can do freelance stuff and get paid to do it. It might not pay all your bills, but if you're a super talented person, whether you're writing, whether you're doing voiceovers, whether you're doing artistry or any of those types of creative things, you can get paid to do it. You just have to market yourself. We have a high school student that lives down the road from us that posted on Facebook a painting that she did. And I immediately messaged her and said, how much for that? And she hemmed and hawed a little bit and threw out a price. And as soon as she threw out a price, somebody messaged back and said that they would pay more.
Yeah.
So this kid, and it was, you know, she's a high school student that, you know, could sell her painting. And she did. I bought it and then immediately sold it to the other person for a markup.
That is the greatest thing ever.
No. I'm currently looking for a proper frame to put it in because it's spectacular. But, you know, that's a high school kid that discovered she has a talent. She went out to the store, the art store, and bought the materials, the tools she needed. And she sat down and she, what was in her head, she put down on the, it's not really canvas, but I mean, she put it down on the art paper and posted it on Facebook without the intention. She had no intention of selling it. She just wanted to show it off. But it just goes to show that if you have talent like that, there's an outlet for you. And I think tools are available. Maybe not so much the encouragement. I think that that's been an old, you know, I want to be a musician, Dad. Yeah, well,
right.
Why don't you learn how to do accounting first and then you become a musician? And I think that's how every music video in the 80s started. I want to be a rock and roll singer.
I'm going to fight for my right to party.
You're going to be nothing. You know, hand me another beer. And then they go out in the garage and they play a song. And it's like, wow, these kids are really talented.
They generate a lot of wind that blows the, you know, the tie back on the stuffy.
A record producer just happens to be driving by in the back of their limo and hear the song from the garage. And
well, okay, so what I'm thinking, and you had a good segue there with the music. So what I'm thinking is, yes, you have millions and millions of creative individuals, but we as a society tend to glom together in certain eras and come out with new movies. Like, everybody influences everybody else, right?
Yep.
So,
like Obama somebody, said, you didn't build that.
Nobody builds anything.
Sorry. I just totally went political and derailed it. Go.
There you go. But, you know, everybody influences everybody else. So you have these genres, these movements, these, you know, frames of time in every medium. But I feel like, and this might be my old fogey coming out, but in many ways we're hitting a wall, at least in some areas. So here's, I've been mulling this over my head for a while now, for years.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like music in this country has hit a weird stagnation. And by stagnation, I don't mean like a dead stop. I mean a vast slowing down of innovation and creativity. So let me lay it out real. I'll just use rock and roll as an example. So you had in there up until the mid-1900s, the same type of music coming around, you know, because you had very limited physical capabilities. And then something like the electric guitar comes out and it opens up things in a huge way. And I know rock and roll is a derivative of blues and stuff like that, jazz. But it became its own thing. So you had the birth of rock in the 50s. And then every decade afterwards, you had major, if not revolutions, at least movements in the genre. So you had the birth of rock in the 50s with Elvis and so on and so forth, the big band types. Then in the 60s, you had a more psychedelic bent to it, or a more like wide appeal or they experimentation.
Influenced by what was going on. I mean, in the 60s, yeah, you're going to get
protest, you know, rock.
Every 100 songs out of 101 songs are going to be about the Vietnam War or something like that. So.
Sure. But the sounds were different. Plus, you had people like the Beatles, you know, experimenting with things, the Rolling Stones,
mm-hmm,
Bob Dylan, people, you know, experimenting and changing the sound. And then you had, like, in the 70s, you had punk rock. In the 80s, you had glam rock. And then moved to the end of the 80s, you had heavy metal. These are very distinct categories that bled into each other. But you could still point to this song is a psychedelic rock of the late 60s, early 70s. This song is a punk. This song is a speed metal. You know, this is Metallica. Metallica does not sound like Pink Floyd. It just doesn't, you know?
Right.
And then you get into the 90s and you have grunge music. And then you start to see it starts to slow down. Like a grunge was like a protest form against the glam rock of the 80s that took a lot from the speed metal. But then what did you have by the late 90s? You had maybe nu metal, which was kind of largely panned. I mean, I like me some nu metal. I'm not going to lie. Call me what you will. But then the 2000s hit. What new, except for, like you said, dubstep might be the only one that you can say. And even then, that's got very narrow appeal. Like, I don't.
Well, let me tell you this. Do you know who Feist is?
Yeah, well, I know that one song that was in a commercial, so yes.
Okay, well, I was reading an interview that Entertainment Weekly did with her, and I didn't even have to finish reading the question, and I knew what her answer would be, because this is the same answer for every musician, every single one, and you're going to hear me out here. Okay. So the question is, what musical influences did you have growing up? Every single time I've ever heard that question asked of somebody creative, whether it's a musician, an actor, actress, yada, 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 straight down the line, 100%, is going to be some fucked up shit that nobody's ever heard of before.
Yeah.
It's going to, well, and maybe not so much nobody's ever heard of before, but that question is, those people are going to reach into their pocket of things that influence them, and they're going to pull out the most obscure thing. Nobody is going to say, oh, I was influenced by, you know, the most mainstream band in the world. You know,
like Elvis, the Beatles.
Yeah, and she does reference Elvis and the Beatles in the sense that she said when she was a kid she was madly in love with Elvis and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the 70s, you're not talking about mainstream. You're talking about people that were shaking things up. You were talking about people that were, like, blasting through ceilings and, you know, coming out with new things and basically reinventing the wheel. Elvis, the Beatles, Kiss.
Right.
Those types of bands in the, like, late 60s, early 70s were still, like, making people blow their minds. Like,
yeah, they're making new sounds.
Right. But, I mean, like, every time you hear a musician ask the question, you know, who was your influence? It's going to be some obscure punk band that, you know, was only playing in one club in London in 1973. You know, it's going to be that kind of shit that they're going to reference. So I think the more mainstream everything became, the more things started to blend together. And especially in, like, the new millennium, the, you know, the 2000, the boy band, pop, you know, things that you can listen to a CD, you can listen to satellite radio, you can listen to FM radio, you can listen to your iPod, you can listen to, you know, this music in like a million different places. Just, it was oversaturation, just total and complete oversaturation of everything that you wanted to hear when you wanted to hear it, and stuff would rise to the top. And you'd probably, I know you wouldn't take back what you just said in that, I mean, there's always going to be some obscure thing that nobody's ever heard of before, but it's not going to rise to the top. You're not going to hear it on radio. You're going to have to go looking for it. You're going to have to, I saw Jack White has his own recording studio. They record straight to vinyl kind of stuff in Nashville. And he has, like, he'd probably have Pearl Jam, he'd probably have Neil Young, he'd probably, but, you know, he's, for the most part, the people he's going to invite into his studio to record straight to vinyl are these one-off people that you've never heard of before.
See, now I get where you're coming from, but, and I, you gave me something to think about that I hadn't considered before, and maybe this is why, because the widespread, easy access that, like, the media we have, internet, and all the different permutations thereof, you can hear like, okay, you go to Spotify and say, okay, I like this song, show me something like it. And then you can go down that rabbit hole where you're just hearing this, more and more music. And the fact that it's so widespread and everybody can hear everything means everybody's everything is just like everybody else's. This is a phenomena that is not exclusive to music. It's a creative phenomenon. What a lot of like companies, a lot of businesses are discovering is that when the conventional wisdom of, get over to a group to brainstorm and we'll come up with the best ideas is dead wrong. It's the opposite of what you want to do. The best way to come up with a good idea to a problem is to give the problem to all your team and have them do individual work.
Yeah.
Because once groups get together, groupthink takes over. Mm-hmm. And one or two forceful personalities take over the whole thing. And everybody else just kind of falls in line and goes, uh-huh, that's a good idea. Oh, yeah. And any original idea that anybody else would have had gets drowned by the people that are at the fore, you know, taking the reins and running with it. And I feel like in the music industry, this might be the same thing. Like, these few forms of music are now the king. And everybody else is falling in line because everybody else is exposed to everything all the time.
Yeah.
There was you know David Wong?
Yep.
Who, he's an author. It's not his real name. It's his pen name. He does a lot for the Crack website.
Mm-hmm.
He did a podcast, and I will never forget this. It was the podcast, the theme was privacy is disappearing, and that might be a good thing. And he argued against it, saying, imagine you're an artist. Imagine you're somebody who's going to be making a sculpture. I don't know if he said that exactly, but this is the gist of it. And everybody's all up in your business all the time. You're live streaming it. You're taking photos of every step along the way. And you're putting it on Facebook. You're tweeting about it. You're doing Instagram, whatever it is. And everything you do is public knowledge every step of the way. You're going to be fed so much unwanted advice. That's stupid. Why did you do that? Doesn't make sense. This doesn't work with this. This doesn't jive well together. That it will be the death of creativity. You will bow to the whim of the ignorant masses because you want to be popular, because you want to be liked. And everybody already likes, people only like what they already liked. They like something new when they're shown something new. So if they're shown something new, but it's not new at the time, I'm kind of rambling on here, I guess. So if you see it step by step, it's not the finished product. It's not new. It's just something different.
Right.
And if you're seeing it's different than what you understand, then you're not going to like it. Whereas if you see a finished product that's new and different and bold, then you might like it. Then that might evoke something in you that you hadn't seen before. But not if you know, nobody wants to see how the sausage is made.
Right. So. Well, and I can see people liking things that are bold. I'm a huge fan, and I used to be pretty cynical about this type of thing. But I mean, when you and I started talking about doing a podcast, I started really thinking about this type of thing and people living out their dream. Now, it's like opened up my eyes a lot, and I applaud anybody that is pursuing anything that they want to do and not giving a single shit about the finished product, whether it's going to be bashed or not.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of when we talked about doing this, that's what I wanted. I didn't want to like pull any punches. I didn't want to be like, well, we can't talk about this, we can't talk about that. The only exceptions were religion and politics, and that's simply because that'll sink a ship faster than anything else. But
And we still squeak that in every once in a while.
But it's opened my eyes a lot to how bold some people are when they're introducing something, especially if they're following their dreams. Anytime somebody's doing something and they're following their dreams, I love it. And it's, you know, not without limits, I guess, but my wife has a high school friend who's on a, he has his own nightly talk show in the style of David Letterman and Jimmy Fallon and Jay Leno, Johnny Carson, those types of things. Mm-hmm. She's good friends with Dan Cashman, and he does that, you know, night show up in Bangor. And like, I feel great for the guy. Like I want to support him in any way, shape I can, because like, he's following a dream. He's doing something that he really, really wants to do, and he's making a go at it, and he's very bold. And that to me is, I don't care how lousy his show is. I mean, even if it's not lousy, I'm not saying it is lousy. I'm just saying that he could fire off bomb after bomb after bomb every single night, and it would still be something I'd stand up and applaud for, because he's doing something that he wants to do, and he's doing something that's following a dream. And I feel like the same thing with, I feel the same way with a sculptor, or the same way with a musician. People that have put themselves out in an original way, in a creative way, to follow a dream, I want to support that.
Yeah.
So I think if there's an opposite to that, and I think that a lot of people fall into that opposite, that, you know, go ahead, dance for me, monkey, and let's see if I like it. And I guarantee you, I'm not going to like it. I think that that's a lot of what society is now. I think, you know, if you can't wrap up your entertainment in a 5-second, you know, internet clip and make somebody laugh, then, you know, they're going to move on. So it's got to be like, and you have to have some Ironsides there a little bit too. You can't allow somebody to sink you with a comment. So
right.
Anytime you're doing something original, anytime you're doing something creative that is yours, you can't let the bad comments get you down. I suppose if they're all bad comments, then you should probably change something that you're doing.
Exactly.
Like, but if you're receiving support, then that should encourage somebody to be creative and to, you know, roll with the punches, but you've got something good.
Like that reminds me of critics. Like, I have a love-hate relationship with professional critics. The love is very slim in that there's so much content out there, like if, especially if I'm dealing with movies or TV shows, that I can and will use critics to filter that. Like if a movie's coming out, I was like, well, that looks intriguing, and I look at it, got universally bad reviews, especially if it got bad reviews from like just regular users, then I'm like, okay, I might just skip this one and you know, spend my time on something else, because there's always something else. But having said that, that's the extent of my love for critics. The fact that there's just so many professional critics out there boggles my mind, because who are you to say what's good and what's not? Mm-hmm. And there's some critics out there that all they say is, this is what I liked about it, this is what I didn't like about it, which I can respect. But the critics out there that says, no, this is objectively bad, like you did this wrong, you did this wrong, you did this wrong. By definition, art is the most subjective thing in existence.
Right.
One person's genius masterwork is another person's mind-boggling piece of crap. I don't get how you can make a career out of just shitting on things all the time. It's amazing to me that anybody can go through it. I feel like people that do that have got to be like so dissatisfied with most aspects of their life.
Right. The way I deal with critics and how I see things is, I have a couple of sources, whether it be, you know, Cinema Blend or whatever I'm using to research whether or not I want to see something or not. I usually have a few that I can rely on, that I know that this person's tastes are going to match my tastes.
Yeah, that's useful. I love to see that, yeah.
But you're right. I mean, I think that political cartoons are the stupidest thing in the entire world. even if I chuckle at it for just a second, I still like the idea of political cartoons, the way that they're presented to us, all that. I hate it. I absolutely loathe political cartoons. Now, they exist for a reason, and there are people out there that enjoy them. If I were to be a critic of political cartoons, I would be terrible at it. I would not be a good critic of political cartoons.
It would always be the same thing. That was dumb.
That was really dumb. That was dumb. That was dumb. That was dumb. That was dumb. That, mm-hmm. I, you would never, ever get one where I'd say, wow, that was, you know,
thoughtful, that was great, insightful,
thoughtful satire. No, it's never going to happen. But that translates to these people that are constantly bashing on movies. I don't know. I don't know how they get listened to. I don't know who's listening to these people that are constantly, you know, jumping down on these movies.
Everything. Simply
everything. And they're out there. I've seen them. There are some that, you know, Entertainment Weekly, I want to say, does a pretty good job rating movies, but it's almost obvious that they're in bed with the production companies. You know what I mean?
Like, they're going to give it a positive blurb one way or another.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, they probably have made a living out of finding that line and walking it, where we need to stay relevant amongst the industry elites in entertainment, yet we need to stay honest with our audience. Yeah. You know? So I can't imagine them putting something in their magazine that they just hate all the time. I'll say that one of the things that isn't fair about Entertainment Weekly is their back page. They have the bullseye, and they'll put up a bunch of pop culture things that are going on that week. And of course, the things that are going well, they'll put towards the center of the bullseye, and the things that they don't think are going well go on the outside of the bullseye. And more often than not, I feel like things that I enjoy are on the outside of the bullseye. And very few times are there things in the center of the bullseye that I'm like, oh, they got that right on. But I think that they celebrate alternative lifestyles. I think very obviously they celebrate alternative lifestyles. So almost, you know, most of the time, something that's towards the center of the bullseye is going to prop up feminism. It's going to prop up the LGBTQI.
LMNOP.
It's going to prop up those types of things. So it's done in such a way that it's almost meant to be funny, you know, because it's obviously a comedian that's doing it, but it's still almost not worth looking at because you know it's going to be, you know, something along those lines.
Well, it's like the concept of like identity politics. You can have identity entertainment. Like, I have nothing against something that's, you know, feminist per se or LGBT or something like that. As long as it's, you know, a good story, a good something to say, something that's actually entertaining. Because if all you're doing is throwing it out there for the sake of throwing it out there, then you're doing just disservice to everybody. Like, one of the examples I was thinking about today of the problem with creativity, the difficulties of creativity. I've mentioned this more than a few times. I was traditionally a comic book fan. I've gotten away from a lot of it, but right now in Marvel Comics, especially, and I don't think DC Comics is doing this quite as much, but in Marvel Comics, especially, they're doing the big diversity drive, which is fine. But the way they're doing it is like a subtle backdoor racism, in that they're taking established characters and they're changing their identities. They're changing, like, Captain America's going to be black. There's a black
Thor's going to be a woman.
Thor's a woman. There's like a Muslim, young Muslim character. If you took all these characters and made them their characters in their own rights, I would applaud you. But the fact that they're shoehorning these characters into their already established identities is very a shortcut, a weak shortcut. Like, I'm not one of these guys that's going to get on my message board and rail against, no, Spider-Man's white, this is bullshit. I don't care. What I care about is it's unoriginal and it's not working. I guess their numbers are not reflecting what they wanted to reflect. And I get that, you know, you get a little kid growing up and, like, you know, Captain America looks like me now. That's great. It seems like, get somebody with some talent in there and have them create a new character that little kids now can identify with, that doesn't have to be taking it from some other little kids that identify with it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like I said, it's like some subtle backdoor racism, saying we can't trust ourselves to create something new and good, so we're going to try to piggyback off something already established. Yeah. And like you said, with this bullseye thing, it's, if you can create content that includes all these different categories and identities, that's good for its own sake, great. But if all you're throwing it out there is like, look at this new edgy, you know, feminist thing I'm putting out there, then I don't get it. I don't understand it.
Right. Well, it's,
I think it's doing a disservice to people it's trying to help, honestly, but that's just my sense.
Well, let's talk about being creative. You and I.
The difficulties, yes.
I don't find it difficult to create anything for this podcast, simply because this is what listeners might be hearing right now is exactly what we'd be talking about around the water cooler.
If you don't like it, well, we warned you right at the beginning. Well, screw you, man.
It is creative in a way that we've come a long way with some of our content and the theme song, and how many theme songs do we go through to get to the one that we have, and the picture that we're having created, but it's from our own mind. But as an individual, I have, I've written some stories. I haven't done much artwork. You know what I can draw really well? You know what, this is going to sound weird, but I can draw it really well, is the Grays.
The Grays.
The Grays.
Oh, aliens! Oh,
aliens, okay. with the giant head and the black eyes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I can draw the Grays very well. But
I draw the Triforce a lot.
Do you?
Yeah, I've been doing it since I was a kid. I don't know why. Yeah. Well, I'm not even gonna say it's well. I just do it a lot.
Right. So you can draw a triangle.
Like three triangles touching corners together. I don't make a 3D, and I make like a shadow. It's good stuff.
It is good. But I think that besides being in band when I was in high school, I'm really not musically inclined. Like,
I did not know that.
Yeah. I can hold my own when it comes to music. I cannot do interpretive dance in any way, shape, or form. I can't dance.
See, now that's spoken like somebody hasn't tried. I want to see you try before you make that blanket statement.
I had a father-daughter dance last night. I tried.
You didn't interpret nothing. You did what you're supposed to do. You got to let yourself go. Put your...
Get a few beers into me.
Get a few beers into you.
Yeah, I've been to a couple wedding receptions where I thought that I was doing some interpretive dance. But I think writing is my creative outlet. And sadly, writing, I feel, is one of the hardest things to do. And I used to write a lot, actually. From the first computer that I got in 94... 95. Might have been 95 I got my first computer. I actually did quite a bit of writing. I've got a lot of that writing on floppy disk.
Oh, wow.
And I've actually bought an old, or it's not old. It's old for the technology. It's a brand new device, but it's a floppy disk drive, external floppy disk drive. And my plan is to go through all my old floppy disks and see if I can find some of that writing. Because...
That's awesome.
Yeah, some of the ideas I had existed in universes that we have today. I wrote a really cool Aliens story back when I was reading a lot of Alien versus Predator books and stuff like that.
So fan fiction.
Fan fiction. I think probably the majority of the stuff that I've written is fan fiction. And I've got a few stories. You've read a little bit of what I've written before. But I think that my niche is the post-apocalyptic type of novel. What I would really like to do, and certainly not my plan to get published, but if I ever did get published, that'd be cool. But I want to do a book of short stories that exist in the same world. So a book of short stories, I guess to be more specific, each story is an individual story, but they exist in the same universe.
Mm-hmm. See, now I love that idea. Like, I feel like I'm going to be name-dropping this at least once per podcast, but H.P. Lovecraft, that's what he did. He did nothing but short stories or novellas, but they, especially as time went on, started all existing in the same universe. He had the same elements that cross over from story to story, the same names, the same ideas. That is a way to make a rich universe, a rich world that doesn't bog down and become collapsed under its own weight.
I think I solved my own problem doing that because in what I'm currently writing right now, which I say currently writing, a lot of it doesn't exist in the world. It just exists in my head. But the three or four things that I have actually put down on paper and or in a computer are all the same book, but they all are different stories. So I think that my logical conclusion was... a couple of the things that I've written have a middle, beginning, and an end, and they're fairly short. And maybe they exist as a good outline or a good short story. And
yeah,
I think that I don't have what it takes. I don't have what's in me to to do a big book like you're doing, to, you know, make a humongous
tome. You might be surprised.
Tome. Yeah, I think about that. I think about, like, what I've got in me to write, and then I think about what time I have to write, and I think about what resources I have at my disposal to write. I don't think that I could, especially if I'm not making my living doing it, I don't think I could sit down and force myself to write a couple pages a day or to do those types of things. I mean, it's a friggin' miracle that I sit down for a couple hours on Saturday night to podcast. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if I had that kind of time, maybe if I retired and did X, Y, and Z, but, you know, for one thing to be born, another thing has to die. And I don't think that I can get rid of some of the things that I, maybe if I spent a little bit less time on my phone.
Yeah, but
maybe if I just add up all that time I sit on my phone playing Egg Inc., I could sit and write a novel. But
so, okay, yeah, well, as Tom mentioned, I have, well, technically I've written a book. And by written, I mean I actually wrote it. I have not published it. And by actually wrote it, I mean I wrote a first draft. But yes, I wrote a book. So it's about, let's see, I hand wrote it, regular size, you know, standard paper, 512 pages, I believe. Like multiple legal pads. Mm-hmm. I just write it. And now I'm typing it up as my second draft. And trust me, anybody, any nascent writer out there, you need a second draft. You always need a second draft. Don't think you get it right the first time, because I've changed so much the second time around. And I've fleshed things out. So it's going to probably end up being, and my handwriting is small enough that each page I wrote is fully a page typed up on, you know, Microsoft Word. I'm going to end up with around 530-ish. So, mm-hmm. You know, a decent sized book. But it's so hard. Like
it is.
It's I benefit from, and I'm hesitant to say this out loud, but I'm just going to say it. I very much benefit from my job because I have a lot of downtime where I can sit there and type and write and do stuff like that. But because, yeah, like you said, it's time consuming. I love it, though. If this book never gets published, never sees the light of day, like you have, Tom, I gave the first, I think, 5 chapters to.
Yeah.
To look over, to tell me what he thought, to find mistakes. And holy crap, were there so many mistakes. After the second time typing it, where I thought I was paying attention, to typos all over the place. Couldn't believe how many mistakes. And you know what? You gave it back to me and I went through it again. I found stuff that you'd missed.
Yeah. Well, and that is a testimony to how, you know, how good your story is. I'll say this for the audience, and I've already told you, but while I was reading it, the first, you know, 20, 30 pages, I had the red pen out and I was just feverishly, anytime I saw a mistake or a double word or, you know, those types of things, I was quick to fix them. And then after that, I was engrossed in the story. I was too engrossed in the story to even do any editing. So, I mean, that's a testimony to how well it was written or how good the story is, because, you know, if you found things that I missed, you know, you're going to have a bunch of eyeballs on it. You know, you'll probably have to read it so many times that you know what's coming, that, you know, that's probably what I would need to do in order to, I'd probably have to read it twice in order to do any proper editing, simply because the first go around, I was just too enveloped in it.
Right. And that's what I find myself doing. The process I have is like, I get it out there. All of a sudden I have an idea for a scene, a dialogue or whatever, and I'll get it out. Boom, 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 boom. And then I'll get, you know, I'm done with the chapter and I'll reread it again. I'll think, okay, I use this word 5 times in 2 sentences. I got to change that around. Or I use, you know, this phrase and it's a little anachronistic or something like that. You know, I'll change, I'll tweak it, whatever. But it's, if this never sees the light of day, I will not regret a second of it, because I actually have fun. This is like a full-blown hobby. I thoroughly enjoy myself when I'm doing this. But I, at the same time, constantly worry. So anybody that's listening to this, if you've undertaken the same type of activity, know that you're not alone in that. I have creating a world that I, because I'm writing fiction, so I'm creating a world, characters, plots, you know, major turning events in their lives, and I feel like everything I'm coming up with, somebody else came up with before. Like, even parts where I think are super original, I will watch a TV show or read another book or see a movie or something, play a video game. This just happened to me. A new video game that came out had a thing in it that's not exactly like an idea I had, but super close. And I wanted to punch my freaking computer monitor when I was playing. Couldn't believe it when I saw it. I'm like, motherfucker. And I've had this idea for years now. And this game just came out a couple months ago.
Yeah.
Couldn't believe it when I saw it. And this happened to me a couple years ago. Just, I was reading a novel by this guy. he has characters that were eerily similar to characters I came up with, which I thought were original. And I'm sitting there double questioning myself over and over again. Is everything just derivative? Have I come up with a single goddamn thing that's new and a unique way to say it?
Well, you have because it's yours.
Right. And I feel like this is what you do with everything, that if you're creative, you have to creative, this sounds pretentious. If you're creating, you have to just tell yourself there's nothing new under the sun. I just want to say something about it in a new way. I'm going to take elements that have already been bouncing around the ether, and I'm going to use them in my own way, in a new way that's enjoyable at the very least, if not unique.
I had a conversation with somebody once that was very protective of their ideas. A very paranoid individual. And every new idea that they came up with, they wrote it down, they placed it in an envelope, addressed it to themselves, stamped it, and sent it through the mail.
Wow.
And their plan was that if they ever had a patent or a novel published or a movie made or any of those things, that those ideas were safely guarded inside the envelope. So if there was any copyright issues or anything like that, they could exhibit A. I have an envelope that I mailed to myself 20 years ago that says that this idea was mine.
That seems like something I should laugh at, but I think that's pure genius.
That's right. I was like simultaneously thinking to myself, this person is insane, but they're also a genius.
That is, I am now sitting here thinking, I wish I had done the same thing. Honestly, I'm really thinking that same thing. Right.
Just so you could win an argument on whether or not you had done it first.
There's an old episode of Friends where Chandler's convinced everybody's stealing his joke. So every time he makes a new joke, he writes it down. You know, Monday the 5th, made a joke at, you know, Central Perk, blah, blah, blah. I feel like I should be doing that, but I never thought about the whole setting through yourself and standing.
Sunny, postmarked.
Where I work, I sit right next to a notary.
There you go. Her
notarize everything.
Notarize it, then send it through the mail.
But then she'd have to read it. And she'd be like, what the hell am I looking at?
Yeah. And then she'd be like, who am I sitting to next to every single day? This person is crazy.
It's like, no, it's not just hardcore deviant porn. It's beautiful art, I swear.
Yeah.
It's also hardcore deviant porn, not just hardcore deviant porn.
All right.
What's this midget doing with this horse? I don't know. You have to use your imagination.
Yeah, you have to read. What is that midget doing with that horse? You want to know, don't you?
Yeah, you're intrigued now, aren't you? And just for everybody knows, that's the name of the book, Midgets and Horses. A love story.
Yeah. What's that midget doing with that horse.com?
That probably already exists. Let's be honest here.
I encourage nobody to go type that into their browser right now. But if you do, let us know.
Please. Oh my God.
So now that I've told you that I feel it's very difficult for me to be creative and I have no time to write and I don't have any time to do this, I'm going to make a pledge to you right now.
All right. $5 for every mile. Oh, wait, sorry.
Different pledge.
Okay.
My pledge to you and everybody listening is I'm going to write something. I have an idea in my head. Mm-hmm. It's for a television show, and I am going to write, at the very least, I'm going to write the basics down in a screenplay format for television, and I am going to have it cross the desk of somebody that's important.
Now, is this the one you were telling me about?
This is the one I was telling you about the other day.
You should definitely do it, because I was very interested in that.
Okay, so here, I'm not going to tell anybody the idea, which what I'm going to do is I'm going to write it down and I'm going to mail it to myself. And then I'm going to write this in such a way that it will get noticed. Even if I get a rejection letter, I want to experiment with this idea of how difficult creativity is. Because me just doing it on a lark here, there's probably, 100,000 other people out there that's doing the same exact thing. And their dreams are bent on them having a TV show made. Or, they're screenwriters out there. And I have no idea how this is going to work. I don't know how people get things approved if they don't belong to a writer's guild. I don't know how they get things, written and sent. So I guess my pledge to you is that I'm going to write something and I'm going to have it sit on some executive's desk, and they're going to either consider it or not. And I'm going to get a rejection letter, or I'm going to get a letter of thanks, but no, but I need, what I'm asking from you is to check in with me periodically to see how it's going, because I want this to be something that we talk about, how difficult it is for one man in his dream to have his vision broadcast via Netflix or Amazon Prime or Hulu or whatever.
All right, consumed
by the mass market.
Every Friday at 3 o'clock, I'm going to ask you, got any letters lately? I'm just going to do that. I'm just going to ask you. Every Friday at 3 o'clock, any letters?
Well, think about it. Think about the absolute trash that clogs up Hulu, Netflix, Amazon Prime, broadcast YouTube. Television, YouTube. And then for every one of those that gets made, I mean, how do those ideas make it? How do they make it? Do they have private financiers? Do they have, you know, my dad is a billionaire, so I'm going to do this? And that's how they get Shark Tornado.
They just saw the right person. I mean, yeah, there's probably who you know aspect to a lot of it. But so much of it, it has to be just the right person at the right place saw it, and that's all you need. Like, I will say all day, every day, the only reason, the biggest reason I even started writing what I wrote is because I read so much sci-fi fantasy when I was a kid that was just utter crap that as time went on, I'm like, I can do a better job than this, and this guy got published. So eventually I was like, okay, I'm going to try to do a better job than this.
It's a common trope, I think, in movies and TV shows that you know, somebody goes out to L.A. with a script and they're trying to get everybody to look at it. You know, that seems to be a thing that actors have to put up with on a day-to-day basis. Hey, will you look at my script? Will you look at my script? Will you give this to so-and-so? Will you give this to... So,
right, like waiters, give it to the guy at the table.
Yeah, it's got to be enough of a thing where a trope exists because of it that us as the viewers have to, or, you know, we understand that as a thing, that there are so many scripts being passed around.
That episode we did about the how to make a movie from start to finish, I said one of the joke things I read was step one was an unpaid intern goes through a stack of submissions and finds something nobody saw before.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be you.
Could be me. I could have my script pass through some unpaid intern's hands.
Lovingly.
I could be the top one on the stack that they pick just to say that they grabbed one, which is all I'm looking for. I'm not looking for fame, fortune, or anything. I am looking for a letter from the executive of Amazon Prime saying, your ideas are stupid. Please stop contacting us.
Oh, my God. If you did get that letter, you should frame it. That would be awesome.
I absolutely would. I'd put it right on the wall here in the bunker. So, check in with me. Eventually, if I do receive anything, even if it's a cease and desist, I'll share my idea with our audience and see what they think.
Stop stalking me. I see you staring at me through my window every day. You got to stop. My lawyers are involved.
But, I mean...
Especially stop touching yourself while you watch me. That's just creepy.
Yeah, that is creepy. But necessary in order
to... You got to get your face in their memories, you know?
Creative juices flowing. I think that's part of why being creative is so hard, too, is that we're influenced by so much, and there is so much that's available, and our daily lives get in the way, and it is hard to get your creative juices flowing. I've decided that prime time, I have a 45-minute commute to work, and that's prime time for me to come up with some pretty creative things.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for me, and you know this, that by the time I reach my destination, whatever creative thing I was thinking about is gone, whoop, right out the window.
Especially lately, I feel like this is
it's almost like
increasing problem.
Yeah, I'll say, hey, I had this really great idea on the way to work, and I don't remember it. So... creative juices are, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult to get things flowing.
Here's what I always say. I'm going to quote Metallica. Boredom sets into the boring mind. By that, I mean, I relish those times. I really do. The only time in my life I'm ever bored is when I'm talking to somebody that completely disinterests me about what they're doing, what they're saying. But if I'm by myself with nothing to do, that's when I can think, you know. That's when I can start mulling over ideas or developing something I've been thinking about a little bit further. If I can, you know, keep my mind on track. Sometimes I can.
Sometimes the imaginary you stabbing them in the eye with the screwdriver gets in the way of whatever you're.
Yeah, yeah.
You bore me.
That's why I hate other people that suck. Like, if I'm with somebody that's boring, I can't. I'm worried about, okay, how do I keep this conversation going? How do I, you know, this person's not leaving. Why are they leaving? Why, just leave me alone then. You have nothing I want to hear. Stop talking about this. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
If you ever meet me in real life and you talk to me for 10 minutes and the most of what I said was, uh-huh, yeah, that's crazy, then you should just not a turnaround and walk away because you're not doing either of us a favor.
Right. You're wasting everybody's time.
Yeah.
Oh, well, creativity's hard.
Yeah, but it makes me hard, so that's good.
Good, good. We've established
that. I made it creepy. Yeah.
That's not creepy.
That's totally going to be a line I use in my book. Quality.
All right. Have we hammered this topic enough, or you got more?
I think so. You know, I feel like there's a whole thing I want to get into. Well, I was thinking about getting into with remakes of movies and so on and so forth. But the more I looked into it, the more I will say, because it's like, and I feel like as time goes on with this podcast, I make myself to be more and more of a snob. Like, I've discovered this about myself. But, you know, the remakes, oh my God, I feel like this is going crazy. Like, I did find this. I want to talk about this real quick. I found this list on IMDb of upcoming remakes or recent remakes and upcoming remakes. And it was disheartening. Like,
how much of that is the nostalgia part of your brain attempting to protect?
Oh, I'm sure that's a huge part of it. But it's also a disappointing part that I have nothing to back this up. I have no numbers. But I feel like it's, for the last at least 10, if not 15 years, it's been increasing over and over. It's ramping up. More and more remakes, more and more sequels, prequels. Just things that aren't new in and of themselves. Things that are attached to something that already came ahead of time.
Okay.
So, like, real quick, I saw this list. Pet Sematary is going to remake. The Crow. The Orphanage, which is not even that old a movie. That, like, 10 years old, maybe. American Werewolf in London. Dirty Dancing. Drop Dead Fred. I mean, holy crap. Another Fletch movie, which I'm sure you might like, actually. But Starship Troopers, this is one that kills me, A Never-Ending Story. I loved that freaking movie when I was a kid, and it holds up. It does not need a remake. For everybody that's like, oh, you know, a new generation should experience.
That brings
a new
up
generation a, experience the first version of it.
That brings up a really, really good point. Because I'm not a fan of remakes as a whole. If there was ever a decision to be made on whether or not to do them or not do them, and that would be the end all be all of it, I would say no remakes. However, I will say that I do believe on some level there are some things that do benefit from a remake.
Yeah.
And I have the perfect example of that. Westworld. Okay. Westworld. Now, you're not getting the exact same story, and a lot of things have been updated because technology's become more available. But in reality, Westworld is such a good story that it almost would have been a shame to have it wasted on a piece of crap movie and sequel from the 70s. So that was primed for a remake, reboot, what have you. Now, I think from the onset, it should have been a television show anyway. Mm-hmm. I think that it benefited from a reboot, and it benefited from becoming a TV show. If they decided they were going to reboot or remake Westworld and it was just going to be a movie, I almost think that it would have been not as good.
It would have been a blip on the radar. Like, nobody really would have paid that much attention to it.
So I don't have a problem with things being remade to expand the story with new special features. But there are some things that I feel are untouchable, and most John Hughes movies are untouchable. Do not fuck with Ferris Bueller. Do not fuck with The Breakfast Club. Don't do it.
Oh, if Dirty Dancing is getting remade, you know Breakfast Club is coming. I'll say that. You know,
well,
that they're the book. Dirty Dancing is not John Hughes, right? Yeah, no.
It's not, but it's on the same nostalgia level.
Mm-hmm.
This is what gets me. Okay, they are remaking The Great Outdoors. Now, this is a movie that for most people was a little bit of just a blip on the radar. But
But I did love that one. I loved that fucking movie when I was.
Love The Great Outdoors. It is such a good movie, and then it also fills that nostalgia hole for me. It absolutely is one of my favorite movies from the 80s. That is getting a remake with Ice Cube.
And Kevin Hart, he's supposed to be in it too.
Yeah, Kevin Hart. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry, not Ice Cube, Kevin Hart.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Understandable, because they're both in a couple of movies together anyway. So.
Yeah, like Ice Cube did the Are We There Yet? And he just recently did the Money Pit remake.
I didn't know they made a Money Pit remake.
Yeah, they rebooted or remade the Money Pit with Ice Cube. And I don't even think it might not have even seen the light of day. I don't know.
I don't know
about some of these, but I especially these sci-fi things I think benefit from a reboot or a remake.
Well, yeah, and I'll agree with you because I was going to say the second part of what, like, I'm sitting there like, I hate remakes. I had to get off my high horse because doing a little bit of research, I realized how many movies I love are actually remakes.
Yeah.
Okay, I found this list. Remakes that are better than originals. Stuff I didn't even know was remake. Okay, Heat is a remake. Yeah. And it's a remake of Michael Mann doing something he already did before, which was like a direct-to-TV movie from the late 80s. Mm-hmm. He did it in 95 with Heat. 12 Monkeys is a remake of a French movie.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Scarface, 1983, is a remake of a movie from 1932, Howard Hughes movie. The Maltese Falcon, the movie, the version everybody knows with Humphrey Bogart, is a remake of an earlier movie that was only made 10 years previous to it.
Yeah.
True Lies is a remake. Of course, The Fly, The Blob, everybody knows that. But those are better than the originals.
Yeah.
You know, these are movies, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is a remake.
Yeah, and at the time, do you think that there were people sitting around going, does this movie really need a remake?
Right, exactly. But the cream of the crop for me, the cherry on top of the whole thing is, and I didn't know this was a remake, but The Thing, one of my favorite horror movies of all time.
Yeah.
This movie did it right from start to finish. I don't think there's any wasted scenes, any missteps along the way. It's a remake of The Thing from Another World from like 30 years prior.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite movies in the world is a remake. So I will freely admit a lot of my hatred of remakes comes from my nose, right? The first time and this nostalgia button can't be reset, and blah, 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 blah. Because there is a lot out there that's a remake that's better. And so I'm not going to write off the concept entirely.
Well, okay. There are a couple of reasons why John Hughes movies wouldn't fly today. And we've recently talked about this, that The Breakfast Club, if you tried to remake The Breakfast Club now, it would just be a bunch of kids in detention typing on their phones, and they wouldn't have the experience that they had. They'd have to completely redo it. Same goes for Ferris Bueller. Hmm. I mean, some of the things that he was doing in that movie were because of the times. Like, yeah. It was revolutionary to have him hack into the school computer and change the days that he's been absent. And, like, nowadays, that would almost be... like, of course he did that, you know, like, that's stupid. That
it would be step one, I mean.
Right. So, but I mean, like, stealing the car and those types of things. And there are themes that certainly could be redone, but that's just, it's not a movie that needs it. It's
not exactly. There's some things that you shouldn't touch.
Yeah. And I'm not just saying that because it's a nostalgia dump for me. I'm saying that movies that don't benefit from a remake simply because we've run out of ideas and we have to crank out X, Y, and Z movies. A lot of sci-fi stuff, I think, could get updated. And Battlestar Galactica is one of those things that the way that was filmed was unbelievable for, you know, like, totally updated. I loved the style that they filmed that in. And the settings were really cool. Just the story suffered. So,
and even then, the story didn't suffer until time went on.
Right, yeah. I mean, two seasons in, it was still firing on all cylinders.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, some horror movies, I guess, could stand a remake. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Some of the reason why that's scary is because of the way it's filmed. I don't know how many people listening to this have not seen the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like, part of that is that campy pulp grindhouse style of filmmaking that's what made it scary. And the characters come secondary to the scenes and the settings and the way, you know, it's just, I don't know. That movie to me got a remake simply because somebody had a love affair with that movie.
Because it was, I mean, there's some things that you know are going to be remade because they're cultural touchstones. Yeah. Like, you knew as time goes on, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is going to get a remake and a sequel on the remake. Friday the 13th is going to get a remake and a sequel on the remake. You know, Nightmare on Elm Street. These things that, if they're popular enough once, that we can throw up the remake and it'll make us money. Having said that, and I know the day is coming, I think we all know the day is coming, and it might be a decade from now, 2 decades from now, they will full on remake the original Star Wars trilogy. I know they will.
It would blow my mind if they did. I would absolutely be floored if they did that.
A new Luke Skywalker, a new Obi-Wan, they will remake those movies and maybe tweak them a little bit and then use that. And I'm not even thinking that's going to happen anytime soon because Disney's got a hold of it and they're going to do, you know, these three movies they're doing now. They're probably going to do another trilogy afterwards. But it's going to peter out enough time that they're going to want to inject some life into it. So they're going to do some kind of, like Star Trek, some weird bullshit time travel stuff, tweak the continuity, and then go from there. Like, yeah. That's going to happen to Star Wars at some point.
Well, hopefully not in my lifetime.
And it might not be. Or it might be when you're like freaking 60 or something like that, you know. Yeah. But I think that the day will come. I really do.
So remakes aren't 100% because of lack of creativity. I think
it's a shortcut. It's an easy way.
It is a shortcut. And to some degree, I think it could be even more difficult to be creative when it comes to that because you have to go into an established industry, or not industry, but you have to go into a film that has established itself and make enough changes where it's yours, but keep the original so it makes sense for you to do a remake.
Well, I agree, and it shows because so many remakes are crap.
Yeah.
So the difficulty is there, and the bar's not jumped.
Right.
In so many different ways.
There are so many movies that are on the block for remakes that if they do remake them, I would never see them.
Yeah.
I can understand it, like Hellraiser. I can understand with effects that they have now that Hellraiser could benefit from a remake. I'd never go see it. Just
unless they went contrary to the trend right now, which is making horror movies, but making them still like PG-13, I wouldn't bother. That could be an entire another topic we talk about, which is like the phobia of making R-rated movies these days. But
yeah, they're breaking out of it now. With
a little bit. The light of day is streaming through a little bit.
Yeah, Deadpool.
And I don't need to see nudity and violence and blood for the sake of nudity and violence and blood, but there's so much suspension and disbelief that I can't put in there when it's watered down for PG-13.
We'll make that a whole topic someday.
Yeah, we could do that later. All right, so you got a trivia question for us today?
I do have a trivia question for you, and this is something that when I learned about it, it really, really made me think about what the hell I thought it meant before. Let me get right down to the nitty gritty. Ted Kaczynski, what's his nickname by the FBI?
It was the Unabomber.
The Unabomber. Why the fuck is he called the Unabomber?
Oh my God, I did just hear this and the weird thing is, I heard it and then I forgot. And then, like, I swear to God, like 2 days ago, I was trying to remember why
he was called the Unabomber.
Why he got the Unabomber.
You see,
I couldn't remember. Uniform? It was not like one. Like, uni didn't mean one. I remember that.
And I always thought that. Like, I always took for granted that they nicknamed him the Unabomber because of one something. Like, he was the number one, like, at the top of the FBI's most wanted list. He was, el numero uno.
Right, yeah, no.
So they were
that's
like,
what I was assuming too, but
he's
the
Unabomber because he's the number one bomber on the list. And then when I found out what Unabomber actually meant, I really had to search in my brain what the fuck I thought Unabomber meant. You're on the right track. It's not uniform, but it does
it's an acronym?
It's more of an abbreviation combined.
Yeah, I got it. Like, that's killing me because I know I just heard the answer to. Okay.
I'll give you a hint. Where did he send the bombs?
Where did he send the bombs? Was it the Germany specifically?
No.
I don't remember.
The UN stands for universities.
Oh.
And the A stands for airlines. So they began shortening his nickname to UNA bomber. And then
University Airline Bomber?
University and Airline Bomber. So when the FBI, when they were doing their late 70s PowerPoint presentations on the Unabomber, when they were taking notes on the Unabomber, on Ted Kaczynski,
wasn't he active in the 90s?
They caught him in the 90s.
Oh, okay.
I think he sent his first bomb in like 76 or something like that.
Wow, I guess all kinds of things about the Unabomber I never knew.
Yeah, his first bomb didn't even hurt the first guy. The first guy that got a bomb was a professor at a university, and the guy it had his return address on it. So he gets this package that's got his name on it that he didn't write. So he called campus security, and the campus security dope walked over and was like, "Well, fuck it, I'll open it." Boom. Blew the motherfucker's hands off.
Oh my god.
And thus the Unabomber was born. But when they were writing out, you know, university airline bomber, it's over time it shortened to UNA bomber, and then it just became the Unabomber. So
bureaucrats love efficiency.
That's right. The FBI always looking for a way to shorten a name. So that's my trivia question.
That's funny, too, because I literally was just thinking about that a couple of days ago.
When you were writing your manifesto?
When I was trying to think of what are they going to call me when I find this shot?
Yeah, they're going to call me the midget that's got a horse.
Midget horse bomber. I'll call the Miho bomber. I'll be the Miho bomber. And well, nobody will know what the fuck it means.
That's assuming you're going to bomb something. Maybe you're not even going to be a bomber. Maybe you're just going to be like nothing illegal, just enough to perk their interest. Like, we have to find out what the fuck this guy's problem is.
I'll be the Miho whoopee cushioner. Serial
whoopee cushioner. That is the third time this week the governor has sat on a whoopee cushion. We have no idea where they're coming from.
And then every politician in the world will use that when they fart on Mike.
Yeah. Oh, there's a whoopee cushion.
There's a Miho whoopee cushioner. Damn it. You got me.
All right. I am going to make the good old call of try to get your trivia question. Have I gotten one yet? I don't think I've gotten one.
I think
yet.
You have. Maybe I think both of us have like pretty much fallen short since like the first one. So
you want to know what's funny is how much I love trivia. And we should do a podcast where you and I just sit here and play Trivial Pursuit.
Boom.
But I know how much you like trivia, and I know you know how much I like trivia. So at work the other day, they ordered food, but nobody could go get it. We have a restaurant that's right next to where we work. And so I volunteered and I went over, and it's at a bar, essentially. So I walk in and it was fucking trivia night. And so I walk in to get the food, and God, I can't remember the question that they asked, but it was like everything I could do to not yell out the answer. I was
like, raise your hand. Oh,
it was, yeah, it was torture for me. Torture to not like blurt out what I thought the answer was, because it was probably going to be wrong anyway. It had something to do with like 18th century Navy. What did the rigging, what did catamaraning mean or something like that? I don't remember. But yeah, I was like, yeah, why me? I walk in and they're doing trivia. I have to go back over to work. I could be sitting here at a bar playing trivia.
You just get to work and just tell everybody the answer. Maybe so. It's like, here's your chicken wings. And by the way, it was a rigging that was used in the 18th century.
Yeah. And yeah, nobody would look at me crazy.
No, not at all.
But I'd love to have a trivia team. I would love to have us go to one of those trivia nights and just absolutely fucking dominate. Although there's probably people that go there like every single week.
Like
professional trivia answers. Then we just have to give them a beatdown.
We could do both. We could dominate and then beat down the second place team just to make sure.
Yeah.
We had no rivals for the weekend.
I got a trivia question for you. How good's your dental insurance? Because I'm going to knock you front teeth. All right. I'm going to give this a shot.
Okay. This one, I'm going to have to word it right, because I have to tweak it to make it within the realm of possibility. Do you know the movie Birth of a Nation?
No.
Damn. Okay. The Birth of a Nation was, it's going to make it hard for you to answer the question, but I'm going to power through anyways. Birth of a Nation was a shitty propaganda movie they made in 1915 about the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, or promoting the Ku Klux Klan, something like that.
Yeah.
And it was pro Ku Klux Klan.
Okay.
So it has the distinction, it has two distinctions of a place in movie history that will never be assailed. Like, it's not going to be one of those, it grossed the most money and then a record that can be beat. But it has this two records that will never be matched, two places in history. I was going to see if you could name at least one of them. So this is an old 1915, black and white, propaganda film glorifying the Ku Klux Klan. It has two historical records, I guess you could say.
Well, I don't think back then the Ku Klux Klan was against blacks, were they? They were against Catholics, right?
No, they were always against blacks.
Oh, Nathan Bedford
Forrest formed it to hunt down former slaves.
Oh, I thought the Ku Klux Klan was against Catholics at one point.
Yeah, they probably always were too. It's a pretty hardcore process.
I know my hometown of Milo, Maine, featured the first daytime parade of a Ku Klux Klan.
Wow. The local, dubious distinctions.
The local Klan, that was the first time they had been maybe photographed in daylight. I don't remember. I don't know. It's stupid. Ku Klux Klan.
They're like, no, God, ah! And they're covering their faces.
Well, no, I think it was a step for them to come out of the shadows because they were stupid. Okay, so the two historical distinctions for this film, Birth of a Nation, that featured the Ku Klux Klan, and the year is 1915.
Mm-hmm. So film is in its early years.
Yeah, so I'm going to say highest distribution.
No.
That's not one of them?
Thankfully, no, because that would say something about America that I don't think we can quite say yet.
What, that we're racist?
Yeah, well, I mean, that a movie about the Ku Klux Klan got high distribution. In the South, maybe, sure, but I don't think we got.
The largest amount of bed sheets on film.
You know, you might have something there. That does sound plausible.
That's the largest amount of pointy hats on celluloid.
It was the greatest Halloween film ever made. Ghosts everywhere.
I got nothing. Aside from fewest attendees in the theater.
Actually, that might be it, because the first distinction is it was the first movie ever shown in the White House.
Oh, really?
So I'm guessing there probably weren't too many attendees, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, it was shown in the basement with the shades drawn.
So 1915, this would have been Woodrow Wilson, right in the midst of World War I. Not when America was
Woodrow. What are you doing?
I didn't see me a good movie with some clean sheets.
Was it fiction?
I mean, it was, I don't know. I never watched it. But it was just, I think it was like a more of a documentary type. It's like, hey, there's this thing called Ku Klux Klan. They're doing some good stuff. Come on, join. Like, it was a propaganda film. So that's the first distinction. The second distinction is that's the first movie ever to get a feature-length sequel.
The hell kind of sequel could they make out of... Well, we told you everything you need to know about the Ku Klux Klan, but hey, stick around for part two. We're going to tell you more.
Part two is Birth of a Nation. Part one was Birth of a Nation. Part two in 1916 was The Fall of a Nation.
Ooh.
Mm.
Is that the one where the Canadians swept down from the north and took us over?
So the New York Times called it lively, interesting, and sometimes preposterous.
Okay.
Oh, sure. Kind of a mixed review.
Yeah, that's either way, it's the Ku Klux Klan, so they're a bunch of dummies.
Yes. All right. So, and it's also considered a lost film because Surviving Prince disappeared decades ago and yet to surface anywhere. I'm thinking David Duke probably has like a 8mm reel that he touches himself to every night, but
yeah, maybe
he's not giving that up for nobody.
So that and Song of the South,
right next to each other. I'm playing back to back.
Yeah, double feature. Okay. Well, is there anything going on in your life you want to talk about? Or
we'll see in the next few months what's going to be happening. It'll be interesting because I will be done typing up the second draft of my book and then the fun starts.
Now, are you going to, even if you don't get somebody to read it and publish it, are you still in the market for making your own book?
Oh, yeah. That shit's going up on Kindle Store easy. One way or another. One way or another, somebody besides my friends and family will read this thing. Might be one person. But somebody will read it.
But what about, like, in paperback?
Oh, I'm not going to. If I was to self-publish it, I'm not going to do a physical copy. I don't have the money to do that. There's no way.
Well, I've looked up some web pages that show how to do it. Not necessarily on the cheap, but how to print your own book and how to publish your own book, essentially.
Yeah.
So
I would definitely do one or maybe a handful just to have like a physical thing I could say, look, I wrote this, you know,
leave it on some doctor's office coffee table.
There you go. Some novelty, like donate to a library or something like that, just as a novelty.
Something that when you become rich and famous that is worth, you know,
right. Yeah.
Billions of dollars.
Actual billions.
Yes. Just imagine
after that period of runaway inflation that America goes through. Yes.
Just imagine how much the notes from J.K. Rowling's first edition of Harry Potter You know what I mean? Just imagine how much the notes would go for on eBay.
Well, like I said, I hand wrote the first draft of everything. I'm keeping that. Maybe, you know, this is the pretentious, you know, asshole part of me, but if I do become rich and famous, that's worth some money. I could dole that out to somebody. You know?
Absolutely.
I'd give it to some sick kid that was a fan. That's what I would do.
Oh, see, now you're just using karma.
Propaganda.
All right. Well, it's good. It's good.
Gonna have to say goodbye for this week. Next week, I'm not sure what topic we're doing, but we'll figure something out.
We will figure something out. I actually had something in mind, but then it flew out of my head, just like usual.
Yes, no, yeah.
I like always. At this point, if I did remember it, you'd have to call the doctors because something's wrong with
me. Well, I wouldn't believe it. I would not believe that would be your original idea. I think you'd be covering for yourself.
I want to talk about midgets and horses.
A wealth of knowledge, a wealth of potential.
Indeed.
Just let your mind percolate on that one for a while. Yeah.
It's very profundicated.
Profundicated. It has been profundicated because we're the masters of such.
Indeed. So, that being said, I'm Midget Mulder.
I'm Bob Scully, as always.
Dip me in your Monday milk.
Dip me in your Monday milk.
All right. See you later.
Goodbye.